This is the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, all about the Arizona Cardinals and the NFL, featuring insider and outsider perspectives. Enjoy the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Now here are your hosts, Jess Root and Seth Cox.
Hello, Arizona Cardinals fans, and welcome to the latest edition of the Rise Up Sea Red podcast. This is episode 246, and I'm your host, Jess Root, from CardsWire.com, the Arizona Cardinals site from the USA Today wire site of the NFL wire sites. And my co-host, as always, is Seth Cox from RevengeOfTheBirds.com, SB Nation's NFL site as well, covering the Arizona Cardinals. And in this edition of the show, it's been a week, but the Cardinals played quite a while ago because they played on Thursday night. They're coming off their mini bye. They're coming off of a close loss to the San Francisco 49ers, who remain unbeaten, 8-0 this year, surprisingly so. The Cardinals lose 28-25 and get a huge performance from running back Kenyon Drake, whom they acquired via trade just a few days before. We talked about the Kenyon Drake trade last week. And so in this edition of the show, episode 246, we're going to talk about his performance and the positives in the win. We're going to talk about some of the negatives in the loss, that is, because it was a loss, not a win. So we'll talk about the positives in the loss. We'll talk about some of the negatives in the loss, which includes the play of Patrick Peterson and what seemed to have happened to him. Moving forward, we'll also talk about the running back situation. What happens once David Johnson comes back? Is Chase Edmonds being forgotten? We'll also look at perhaps resetting some expectations for the season based on what we've seen through the first 9 games. What are realistic expectations, and what games can we expect to win the rest of the way? And then we'll look ahead to their next matchup this weekend, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, whom they will play on the road in Week 10. That's coming next on the show. Let's go ahead and get started. So let's start off with looking at the positives from the loss against the San Francisco 49ers. Seth, I guess the biggest thing that we look at is how amazingly good was Kenyon Drake on Thursday. To come in on a Monday, they had traded on a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday's in the game, and he puts up, 162 yards from scrimmage, 110 yards rushing. Very first play, he touches the ball 36 yards. How impressed were you by him and what he was able to do with his opportunity?
I think it was just kind of what we have been waiting to see consistently from David Johnson. And so to see it from a running back in Drake, we saw it 2 weeks ago from a running back in Chase Edmonds, but this was a little bit more all around, kind of what we saw from a 2016 David Johnson. So I think what they were able to do on, 3 days, 2 days, was astounding. But I think it goes back to what you and I have talked about basically since January, when they announced that they hired Cliff Kingsbury. Kingsbury's greatest strength is his, just how good he is at creating opportunities for offensive players. It's something that we've seen, like I said, with David Johnson in the passing game. It's something we've seen with Chase Edmonds in the running game. I mean, he and Sean Coogler are getting the most out of what most of us would say on paper is a awful offensive line, and they're getting maybe slightly below average play, but that's such a huge improvement from what we've seen in years past that Kingsbury's ability to, identify and then fit in talent is very unique comparative to what we're used to. He is much more in the mold of a Sean Payton than he is a Sean McVay. Because if you look at how Payton has done things with Drew Brees and then the wide receivers he's invested in, he's never really had, a guy until Michael Thomas that was the guy. Like, they never really invested highly in wide receivers. They traded for Brandon Cooks at a time, and those things, but they never really, they're not Atlanta, even really, a team like the Cardinals, who have thrown a ton of draft picks at it, they're more in the realm of New England, who they're like, hey, let's get these receivers that fit what we want to do, and then kind of adapt and mold them. And that's just what Kingsbury's done. And caught on Thursday, where, granted, San Francisco's greatness is rooted in their dominance against the pass, but they are no slouch of a team against the run. And the Cardinals, at the end of the day, forced them, I believe it was, their yards per game given up, yards per game after we game against the Cardinals offense. And we've talked about that quite a bit. I mean, what Kingsbury has done in the running game with their, you know, kind of advanced metric rankings as, you know, a top five rushing team via Football Outsiders DVOA is really astonishing when you think about just how archaic and bad it was literally 1 year ago.
And it really, the first of all, when you look at how, when you look at the way the Cardinals, well, Kenyon Drake, I mean, 110 yards. You know what's kind of fun to see is now we have to temper this excitement a little bit. And I'm going to say this is remember when we got Adrian Peterson a year ago or 2 years ago, and what did he do like with his first carry? He busted through for a big game. He had a huge game. Chase Edmonds in his first start has a huge game. Kerwin Williams in his first start had a huge game. That seems to be kind of the MO for Cardinals running backs in their first stint. That said, Drake looked every bit like a David Johnson. The hunger with his running, the sort of intensity, the way he attacked things. And that's perhaps the one thing that David Johnson has changed in his running style. It doesn't feel as urgent, whether that's technique and strategy with his new coach and going through multiple running backs coaches. But, I mean, in addition to, like, the Cardinals offensively, this is a post I put together after the game. This San Francisco defense was fantastic. Fantastic. So they're number one in yards. They were number one against the pass. They were number two in points allowed. And they were like number 11 against the run. So like Seth was saying, they were no slouches, all things considered. Here's some of the things that the Cardinals did. So one, while they didn't put up mad yards, they put up 357 yards of offense. That's the most the 49ers allowed all season. They rushed for 153 yards. That's the most the 49ers allowed all season. They had 204 net passing yards. That doesn't seem like a lot, but it was only the second time all year that they had given up more than 200 net passing yards. Murray threw for 241 yards. He's only the second quarterback this year to throw for over 200 yards. And the other one is Andy Dalton. You know, it's Andy Dalton's a decent quarterback who can put up some numbers. They scored 25 points. It was the first time that they had allowed, that's the most they had allowed, and no other team had scored more than 20 points against them. They're the only team this year to score three touchdowns against them, and they were the first team not to turn the ball over. So if you look at a lot of the positives, almost all of it, you can bottle up and look at the offense and the offensive system that the Cardinals are playing with. Those are all very, very positive things. So not only are they, like, they put up big numbers against three bad teams, the Giants, the Falcons, and the Bengals. Those are all bad teams. And they piled up the points and the yards on those bad teams. And now you take a very good team and you play respectably well. The offense, let's put it this way. The offense played well enough to win. Let's put it that way. The offense, simply put, the offense has played well enough to win and to beat a 49ers team that still has not lost this year. They look like one of the best teams in football. And so that you take that and you're like, wow. And they're still not getting any sort of real production from their receivers. And that's the amazing thing. And this offense has gone from a receiver-centric system, and Kingsbury has adjusted, and it now is running back centric. It's running centric. It's the run rate or the ground rate or whatever you want to call it. And you and I have had conversations with Blake, one of your guys from your side who has the other podcast, the Revenge of the Birds podcast, and you know, he has long compared Kingsbury in terms of his innovation in the running game to be more Kyle Shanahan than Sean McVay. As we've seen, if you look at the career of Shanahan, he has evolved as a play caller. He's had to do different things offensively in almost every stop, you know, Washington, Atlanta, now San Francisco. He's shown innovation and success in a number of different ways, and it looks like Kingsbury is that guy, and it's exciting to see because clearly the strength right now of this offense is the talent is more in the running back position than at the receiver position.
Yeah, and that's kind of the crux of the issue right now is that when you look at where the talent lies on this team, it's at the quarterback position, obviously, but it's also with the running backs. And so you have to mold your team into what you have as opposed to what you want it to be. And I think that's the difference between good coaches and great coaches. Good coaches have a scheme that they can get players to buy into and work with. Great coaches are ever evolving and changing their schemes, whether it be week to week or year to year. And it's something that we've seen. And when I say all this, I'm not putting Cliff Kingsbury on this level. So I don't want anybody to think that, because at the end of the day, the bottom line is always winning is, you know, is the only thing that matters. But when you look at a guy like Bill Belichick, for 20 years, what he's done in New England, and you kind of look at, you know, at first it was defense running the football, sprinkling in Tom Brady, and then it was this all-out aerial assault where they ran the ball well enough, they got enough stops on defense, but they could score from anywhere on the field at any time, to kind of this, I mean, he brought into vogue the two tight end, back into vogue, the two tight end sets until, you know, one of those tight ends decided that murdering people was better than playing football, and then he brought back, you know, the kind of running back by committee, having a running back that could run the ball, having a James White type back who could, you know, first was Deion Lewis that could catch the ball out of the backfield and run the ball. I mean, so he's this guy that's just evolved with the times and with what his talent is. Now, having Tom Brady really allows you to be evolved. And again, Cliff and Kyler are nowhere near that. However, in this system, you can see that Cliff goes, hey, right now this is what we need you to do, Kyler. He's protecting the football. He's being asked to keep the offense on time and in rhythm so that they have manageable situations. Even in that game, even in the game on Thursday night where you're like, man, they're just not good enough to compete with San Francisco, all they needed was one stop to get the ball back to, at worst, tie it and potentially win the game. And it just came down to the defense isn't there yet, something we've talked about quite a bit. But offensively, you know, you laid out the numbers. They did more than enough to win the game, and they gave their defense enough opportunities to win the game. So while Cliff has had mistakes with time management, timeouts, things of that nature, his game planning and preparedness is probably the best I've seen out of any Cardinals coach, and that includes Bruce Arians, and that's not a shot at Bruce, but Bruce came in with an identity. This is who Bruce Arians is, and this is what we're going to do. And it took 8 games in 2013 for the team to buy in, and then they bought in and they had this, you know, fantastic 2.5-year run from there. Even dealing with, you know, monumental injuries to their best, you know, player on offense in Carson Palmer in 2014, to their best, you know, the heart and soul of their defense in 2015, Tyrann Mathieu. So all of those things, you know, kind of went against them. They had this good 2.5 year run, but that's why it was not sustainable for Arians, because once you start to lose the chess pieces, you have to be able to adapt, and that's not who Bruce Arians is. And we're seeing it in Tampa right now a little bit, where there's this struggle because the offense is producing at a very good rate, but in Bruce Arians' fashion, he takes a lot of chances, which puts his quarterback in a lot of situations to turn the ball over. Jameis Winston has done that and then more. And so when you're asking your quarterback to, hey, we need you to get these deep routes, we need you to throw these down the field type things, you see what happens. And then tying that back into Cliff and Kyler, what happens with Cliff and Kyler, they came in with a different idea, and we all know that. They thought they were going to spread it out, they were going to go four wide, they were going to throw the ball around the field like it was college, and then they started to realize, crap, our receivers aren't great. You know who is great? Johnson. You get a matchup with him on a linebacker or a safety, that's a win. You know who else is really good? Chase Edmonds. Chase Edmonds can run the ball really well. So all of that factors in, and now all of a sudden you bring in a Kenyon Drake who does the same thing, you know, similar to, he's kind of that hybrid between what David Johnson is now and what Chase Edmonds is now, and all of a sudden you've got a back that can, you know, on 3 days, you know, study, go out and put up 160 total yards of offense.
One other piece to look at, and you have to look at the play of the offensive line, as they had the first real shifting they had to do, because their depth has been tested. Justin Murray, we don't know how serious his knee injury is. It sounds like he's going to be out for a few weeks. Just as I'm trying to gauge Cliff Kingsbury's comments on injuries, which includes he's working through it, which means you're probably looking at multiple weeks. So Justin Murray, his availability was in question, which meant, oh goodness, what are they going to do at tackle? And they did what we thought they should have done at the beginning of the year when Marcus Gilbert got hurt, and they moved Justin Pugh from left guard to right tackle, a position he hasn't played in years. It's not his strongest position, and then they put in Mason Cole, and it's, you might say, this perhaps is the best offensive line. Perhaps you have to decide whether Justin Pugh's better at right tackle than Justin Murray, or if he's enough better than the potential downgrade from Pugh to Mason Cole at left guard, because Pugh's been pretty all right. Actually, the interior of the line's been solid, but you look at this line, which apparently now is a top 10 line in the NFL, if you look at some of the analytics, just they continue to, one, be durable, except for that right tackle position, and two, they're being cohesive, doing things we never thought we'd see them do.
Yeah, and it's interesting because a lot of that gets attributed to Kugler, and I think he does deserve credit for what he's done. I think he's, you know, helped the offensive line quite a bit. But again, I go back to, and I know he's a hot commodity, so he's well respected around the NFL. But the people I talked to in Denver weren't exactly broken to see him go. Now, maybe that was they got Mike Munchak, blah, blah, blah. But it wasn't like, oh, my gosh, I can't believe we are going to have to absorb that loss. So when you look at it, you just kind of see that Cliff's scheme is – it puts players on the offensive line into a position to be successful – because it's asking them to kind of get downhill on blocks, which, you know, I would say probably 75, if not greater, percent of linemen prefer in run blocking. And then they're using the short passing game to really negate a pass rush as much as possible. And then you see, I mean, you see Murray, too, being able to find ways to bail out his offensive line at times too. So that's kind of where you're seeing the growth at, is that Cliff is scheming, hey, let's get the ball out, you know, catch the ball, get the ball out quick, you know, in under 3 seconds, under 2.5, really. And then on the flip side, when there are breakdowns, Murray's able to escape. And like last game, people wanted to blame him for that sack that he took, that lost like 19 yards. But the reality was, the only reason that he lost 19 yards was because he was quick enough to avoid the first pressure. And that's where he's got to remember that a 9-yard sack is better than a 19-yard sack. And that's just, you know, that's going to, again, come with time. But also, to his defense, and, you know, this is something that I don't know if you really want to coach that out of him. Because at some point, as the team continues to grow and you see talent at the wide receiver position get better, he is going to make a play where he's able to escape that initial or even the secondary pressure and then find a big play down the field. I mean, we saw it a little bit in the New Orleans game. He just missed a throw to Christian Kirk. But I think coaching that out of him could be a detriment as much as it could be a detriment to his long-term ability as much as it would be as a help to his short-term success.
Coming up next on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, let's move on and talk about some of the negatives. We got Patrick Peterson, we got some questionable decisions by Cliff Kingsbury. That's coming up next on Rise Up Sea Red. We're back on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web, and we now come back and kind of circle around to the things that didn't go so well. There were two, like, obviously, the negatives have to do with the defensive side of the ball, and namely, the two things that stand out are, one, some decisions by Cliff Kingsbury, and then also the play of Patrick Peterson. How egregious was Peterson's effort / performance for you in that game?
You know, I went back and forth for a while on it, and I just ended up being disheartened by the fact that there were plays where it looked like he quit. And to me, that is the worst thing you can do as a player, is look like you're not trying for your team. And I thought, and I don't know how you feel, but I thought we saw that several times in this game, including against the run a couple times. So to me, his effort was not what you expect from a guy that is in his, what, ninth season, that's been an All-Pro. You wouldn't expect that type of effort and you wouldn't accept that type of effort from a rookie or something of that nature. So if you shouldn't accept that effort from a guy that is supposed to be one of the what's the word I'm looking for, leaders of this team.
You know, as the more of the, and I've listed up Cliff Kingsbury. Kingsbury was very there's the joke. Kingsbury defended Peterson the way that Peterson should have defended the receivers against San Francisco. So there's that. Ha ha ha. After the game, Kingsbury was not critical of him. He said, you know, he's getting back into game shape. It was a short week. He's still in a new system. I kind of buy. I buy that to an extent. And maybe the expectations that we as fans have had of him are his fault, not because of his previous play, but because of what he said in the time leading up to his suspension. He said he was gonna, you know, he'd be working out in game shape. He kind of detailed how he did that. So he'd go out in the football field and rep game reps. Obviously, he wasn't gonna be getting the physical play with the tackling, things like that. So he said he'd come back and play 10 games of the best player of his career. When the reality is, so he set himself up to disappoint if, in fact, he still has a couple of questions, that he still has a little bit of a few things that he doesn't know in the defense, because it is a new defensive scheme, and he wasn't allowed to study. So that's the other part to the suspension. He wasn't allowed to even have an iPad from the team with the playbook loaded. Or he couldn't have any contact with the team. He had to turn in his all the team gear, you know, all the team materials. And so he was blind. He came in blind. And it was based on it. And out on top of that, he missed a lot of the voluntary workouts in the offseason where they were repping things. So he got reps during the preseason, but he missed a lot of time. So what Kingsbury said is absolutely right. He is completely on point in saying, well, we do have to realize that he was coming off his couch 3 weeks ago. He hasn't been in playing shape. On top of that, it was a short week. I buy all that. But part of that is Peterson's fault. That said, I feel that while Peterson's effort, and if you look at over the course of his career, he has had those moments where he's bailed on things. Like the Pettis touchdown, he made a mistake early. There was a misstep, and he was supposed to take him early, and he didn't. And once he was beat, he was beat. And we didn't. And now, obviously, it wasn't going to change anything. He wasn't going to catch up with Pettis on the touchdown, but his body language was bad. We said it a couple of times. Now, I don't blame all the problems on him, because guess what? It seems like Vance Joseph is still not willing to actually do what he said that he was going to have, that they were going to be a press man defense that generates pressure. And what we just have not seen much man coverage, just having Peterson line up man-to-man on those guys, and even to a little bit of detriment, having when they've slid him inside into the slot a few times, that's actually not ideal. I mean, you want him to travel, but the problem is when you move Peterson inside, you cause problems schematically for the rest of the defense. So some of his issues, okay, Peterson, he's got some things that and he set himself up for some failure. I expect he bounced back. But the problem, like the main thing for me, the fact that he wasn't able to bounce back physically as well in 3 days on that short week, are we starting to see the downhill? Not that is going to be bad, but on short weeks, it's like, if there's ever any sort of downtime that he has again, we might see a stinker or two like this. But I'm going to put a lot of the blame is Vance Joseph's scheme is just, what is he doing right now? What is he doing?
You know, that's what my biggest question is, and why when people say, hey, fire Vance, I don't necessarily defend Joseph, because I don't understand or know what he's doing. You know what I'm saying? So you
for,
look
for
at
the first
it,
6 weeks of the season, you kind of get it. He's sort of protecting his defense as a whole. But now that you've got Patrick back, what are you doing?
Right, and so you are able to kind of be like, okay, I get that there are some talent issues on this team. However, now that you have Patrick back, who's supposed to be one of the top corners in the NFL, why are we not seeing a greater response and you know, better outcomes? And so that is why, while it's still early and I'm still willing to continue to give him the benefit of the doubt, I'm also really watching what Vance does these last seven games, because this is as much of a tryout, or, you know, kind of audition for him to keep his job, as it is for, you know, the guys that are kind of on that roster bubble, so to speak, heading into next year, to, you know, staying with the Cardinals. And so that's my Joseph take. Here's my very limited Peterson take, and I'm just speculating. I'm wondering. I have no inside information. The way he's played thus far coming off of a PED suspension does make you wonder slash have concern that maybe he has dabbled before in PEDs, or he knew something was going on that was leading towards his decline and thus started to take the PEDs. Those are, again, my hypotheses. I'm not saying that's what is happening or did happen. That is just my guess on the entire situation.
Well, and it's a completely fair question. When you come back from a PED suspension and your play is less than stellar, it raises the question.
Well, when it's dropped off as when it's dropped off as drastically as it has for them,
you're like,
or
did
for
he
him,
need it?
Right, like that's what the concern becomes more than anything, because then you look at it and you go, oh, there is an issue, right? So and then you're like, oh, I kind of understand why he started taking them, or worse, has he been on them for a longer time and then just finally got caught the first time? So those are, I mean, and like I said, I'm not saying either of those things are accurate. It just, that makes your mind goes to those places when you see what his performance has looked like. And I think the final kind of thing is Deion Sanders tweeted out that the Cardinals needed to do the right thing and trade him. When you go back and look at Deion's history, I'm not saying he speaks for Patrick, but I am saying that he is a guy that speaks some of what he's probably heard from Patrick. And that makes me think that could there possibly be this F you didn't trade me, you know I wanted out, I tried to make everything right publicly with the team and you promised me to do something, you know, about it, and I'm still here, so this is what you're going to get from me effort wise I think that's if his effort continues to lack, not necessarily that he's getting beat, but that you're seeing him quit on plays, entire plays, I think that's where you do start to scratch your head if there's a deeper thing going on than just, oh, he's strictly regressing, which is what I think you and I would hope it is, but we're also not completely naive to the fact that it may not be.
Now, one other thing that I kind of want to talk about, and this is, I want to get your take, and it's a few days removed, but Cliff Kingsbury was criticized for some decisions that he made, two in particular that kind of stood out. One was at the end of the half, he calls a timeout, basically he ices his own team, and the Cardinals get this out. San Francisco, 4 seconds left on the clock. They decide on fourth and goal at the one, instead of kicking the field goal, they decide to go for it and go for the touchdown. They run a play. It's a run play, and it's stuffed. But Kingsbury called timeout, and so the stuff doesn't count, and they get to replay it, and they score a touchdown. The other one was with a little more than 2 minutes left in the game. And he challenges a spot which would have potentially give for San Francisco to punt if it was upheld, and if it wasn't, then it would leave the Cardinals with only one timeout. What were your takes on those particular two decisions? How terrible were those decisions in your book? And were the decisions? I'm going to have a really mild take on this because I didn't have a problem with either one of those calls. I think, personally, my take is, I think everyone's upset, everyone's anger towards Kingsbury's decision is not about the actual decision, but about the results.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I don't think his decision's wrong. It was like the fourth down call in New Orleans. You and I both agreed with the go, we just didn't like the play. So, you know, I don't think that there was anything wrong. They were going to call timeout no matter what. They were going to, you know, he called it a vanity timeout. They wanted to see what formation San Francisco came out in. And I think that that's kind of what happened there.
And he just called it too late. And they, right. If he had called it 2 seconds earlier, nobody complaining. Cares.
Right. And the reason it worked was they had Hassan Reddick in the right spot. I mean, let's be honest, Reddick was there to cover back out in that situation, and which just happened to be Emmanuel Sanders. It's just that despite the fact that everything that we were billed on Reddick about, you know, his athleticism and coverage ability and yada yada yada, he doesn't actually do any of that well.
He's a step slow in reaction.
Right. And so, like, I mean, literally, if he just knows to look, you know, to stick his arms out or make any type of play on the ball, he either knocks it down or he picks it off and is running. You know, if he scores, that's another conversation, but he's running it back for a potential pick six. I mean, he was literally in position. They just – if he's 1 foot over to the right, it hits him in the back, or Sanders is not covered. He just took a horrible angle on his coverage, and it just worked for them. And then I've already tweeted out my thoughts on this challenge. And people can disagree with me all they want, but I'm right. and so Kingsbury knew without a shadow of a doubt they were not going to stop them on a third down play. They just weren't gonna stop them. So that puts you at fourth, and even if it's a half a foot, you still force San Francisco to make a decision. You force San Francisco to say, do we really go for this? And then give them a, you know, two play drive where they're in range to tie it, or do we punt this ball and give the ball back to a quarterback that works best in this frenetic, you know, kind of up tempo pace? And I thought at that point it was the right play. I mean, hell, they got him in third and long again, and they just didn't get a stop.
Correct. So, I mean, ultimately, for me,
like, it's not like.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, so it's not like the timeout cost them the game because they got them in third and long again and just couldn't get a stop.
Right. It would have been another thing because the challenge didn't affect anything because they never made a stop. Had they made a stop and then they ended up running out of time, then you go, okay, that might not have been. But they still had to get a stop and they didn't do it. And the truth of the matter is, two timeouts, one timeout, you could go either way. You can still make do with that with the way you manage it, getting out of bounds or clocking the ball. And so there were ways around that. There was more, especially since he had the view, it looked like it was short. Now, challenging spots is almost foolish every single time. But in that case, there was no real downside in many ways. And so I had no problem. Honestly, I didn't have any problem with either decision. And I think most of the people, in fact, like we've seen, if Kingsbury is successful on those, or if he calls timeout 2 seconds earlier on that, on that stuff never happens and no one ever questions it, because that's common among coaches. If they make the first down in New Orleans, then no one's criticizing them. They're calling him innovative and risky and gutsy and things like that. So it's really about the results, and you know, you're gonna fail on some calls. It's happened before. Bruce Arians went for it on fourth down late, early, and you know, deep in his territory against the Houston Texans a couple years ago. Then regretted the play call and then doubled down, saying, "No, the play was there." And so we've seen Bruce Arians do the same thing. I have no problem with it. Coming next on the Rise Up Seared podcast, we're gonna move on from the game. We're actually gonna talk about, well, guess what's gonna happen. What happens now with David Johnson and Kenyon Drake in the backfield? And is Chase Edmonds suddenly kind of getting pushed out of the conversation. That's coming up next on Rise Up Sea Red, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. We're back on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. David Johnson is expected to return to the lineup against the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Chase Edmonds is still out. And so we get to see a 1-2 punch of Kenyon Drake and David Johnson, or David Johnson and Kenyon Drake. And it's funny because the comments that Kingsbury made talked about having two very talented, two dynamic backs, and it almost felt like, in one sense, it felt like he'd sort of already forgotten about Chase Edmonds, or you get, as much as they like Chase Edmonds and the efforts that he's done, they don't really believe in him as a long-term, full-time guy. And so you get Johnson and Drake, so it feels like he just, oh, those are two guys, and then Chase is the other guy. Now, I'm going to say for the record that I think what his comments were talking about was simply leaving Chase out of the conversation because he's still weeks away. And so, right now, he doesn't have three running backs. He only has two good running backs.
Yeah, and I think that's probably what it really is, but I think it's also that they are excited to have Kenyon Drake in-house. I mean, he's done a really nice job for the team. He's played well. You've seen quite a bit of what David Johnson is at this point. So maybe their running back situation becomes more Chase Edmonds and Kenyon Drake based in terms of strictly running the football, and we're seeing more of David Johnson, kind of the H-back, fullback, tight end, hybrid. We're seeing more David Johnson in you know, flexed out into routes more to take advantage of where he is still dominating matchups. I think the fact that three of your best offensive players are all running backs is not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, it's unconventional. But we're seeing it in places like we've seen it in places like Baltimore, where the Ravens have, you know, Mark Ingram and Gus Edwards, and then they sprinkle in, I believe it's Justice Hill as the rookie, you know, and they use a ton of tight ends as well. We're seeing it in New England, where you know. Game to game, it might be Sony Michel, it might be James White, it might be Rex Burkhead. I mean, heck, we've got Brandon Bolden in situations where he scored two touchdowns in a game. So you could utilize this three-headed monster similar to what the 49ers do with Tevin Coleman, Matt Breida, and then is it Raheem Mostert. But you could also see it turn into kind of what San Francisco does with Breida and Coleman and Kyle Juszczyk with David Johnson kind of playing that, again, that pseudo tight end, H-back, fullback role where he's being utilized in a number of different ways. So I think there's a lot of talent. I think there's a lot of talent in the backfield, and that Cliff is smart enough to utilize that talent to the best of its abilities and make sure the right guys are on the field to give his team the best chance to win.
Now, what I'm interested to see is how much, and this will be really what defines Kingsbury as a guy that adjusts and is flexible. How much do they have Drake and Johnson on the field at the same time? I have not given up on David Johnson as a runner. If you look at the numbers that he's had this season, while he has not had the Chase Edmonds game, he hasn't had the Kenyon Drake game, but in the three games that he got at least 15 carries, he was very good. He didn't bust off the 40-yard run, but his numbers were quality. And so I still think that he needs the volume. Now, if they're going to work this in, I think it would be, if you build this offense around the two of them right now, and kind of Christian Kirk and Larry Fitzgerald fit in, I think that in a perfect setting, I think David Johnson, who still makes this offense, you know, with him and Drake, you have guys that can make, that create mismatches and can win battles. You give David Johnson 15 carries, you give Kenyon Drake 10, 12 carries, and then you're giving them, each of them, 5 or 6 targets in the passing game. I think you have the opportunity to really do some fun things offensively. And then you've got your Demir Byrd and your Andy Isabella and your Trent Sherfield, where you're going to hit down the field, and then you've got Christian Kirk as your volume receiver. And then, and honestly, if they end up throwing the ball more, Fitz gets more opportunities. Otherwise, I think his usage is going to go down in this type of offense. But he doesn't care if they're winning. And so I'm really excited to see what happens moving forward. And once Chase Edmonds comes back, how he fits. I would bet if I had to put money on something this week, I'm going to say that probably Kenyon Drake might be more of the bell cow this week, because it'll be Johnson's first week back. Although I am interested in seeing Drake's follow-up game. If we go back to kind of the Adrian Peterson thing, his first game was great. Second game, not great at all. Chase Edmonds' first game is with a full load, fantastic. Second game, very ineffective. Now, partly that was volume. And so we've got Kenyon Drake doing great. What's he going to follow this up? Is it going to be followed up with a 10-carry, 28-yard thing? That could happen. I mean, we've seen backs be dynamic and then disappear in their second game. But I want to see them both against Tampa Bay, and I want to see them both and Chase Edmonds moving forward. And if this becomes a San Francisco Baltimore Ravens type offense, well, let's do it, because the Cardinals obviously are putting up points when they run the ball more. This offense is better when they run the ball. And it's so whatever the concepts were initially, the running game is kind of what drives this offense right now.
And that's the thing is, you know, when you have potentially 4 guys that can gain over 500 yards of on the ground, and the Cardinals do now. I mean, Edmonds may be the guy that ends up short if Drake ends up being kind of the pseudo 1-2 or how with David Johnson. But, you know, David Johnson's just about 200 yards away. Kyler Murray's just about 200 yards away. And then, you know, like I said, Drake or Chase Edmonds. But if they end up with 4 guys over 400 or, you know, or close to 500 yards, that's going to be, you know, impressive, because that's a team that has balance, that has a number of weapons they can use. And then Kyler's still going to throw for over 4,000 yards. So you're talking about potentially having over, you know, 6,000 yards of offense. And that's just saying they all get right to, you know, 500 yards. And so if you end up with, you know, over, you know, close to 7,000 yards of offense, that'll be a huge growth from last year. Because we're already seeing the growth in terms of, you know, touchdowns scored, points per game, time of possession. So to see the yardage continue to kind of pile up and them to be able to win in multiple ways, I think, again, that goes back to Cliff's ability to adapt as he needs to and the growth that, you know, we hope to continue to see from him as a coach, that then starts to stack into wins as well as not just, hey, we're really close to being able to compete.
Come to next of the Rise Up Sea Red podcast. With the change in how things are going, and with perhaps kind of the new outlook we have on how the Cardinals can compete, let's look at the rest of the season. Let's reset expectation and look at what games are winnable the rest of the way. That's coming up next on Rise Up Sea Red. We're back on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. The Cardinals sit at 3-5-1, and it was tough there. At one point, it looked like, how many games are winnable? We started to wonder if they're going to win any games. Then they rattled off the three in a row. Then they were brought back to reality against the Saints. But now they play a very good San Francisco team, and it looks like, you know, they, again, the offense played well enough to win. The defense failed them. The offense did enough to win the game. And if the defense makes one or two plays, they are the talk of the NFL right now. But let's look forward on the schedule. How many wins now are possible? Where are there games where we are looking at is should wins now? Because I am. And maybe because our expectations at the beginning of the year, well, before the season, we were both thinking kind of 6 or 7 wins. Then the start of the season happened, so wait, maybe they're going to be, and we kind of posed the question, are they going to be equal in record? Are they going to be a 3 or 4 win team, but still just be much better a team, even though if the wins don't show it? And now with the wins, we're looking at it again. Seth, what are your expectations moving forward for this team? How many wins do you think they get? What games should they win? And can they sneak any other surprise wins?
I would say when you look at their schedule, they have 4 games that I would consider winnable. That would be this week against Tampa Bay, which we'll get into. That would be then the game against the LA Rams in Arizona, and then the next 2 games after that, the Cleveland and Pittsburgh game. I don't know if I got those backwards, but I might have, but you know. So those 4 games, I would say, are winnable, which sets you up right around 7, which is where I kind of had them at the beginning of the season. Now, I'm not saying they're going to win all those games, because that would be impressive to see this team finish 7-8-1 with how bad their defense is and how bad their offense has struggled to score when in the red zone. When you look at other games, San Francisco, you know, in San Francisco, the 3 road games left are San Francisco, in San Francisco, and then in LA and in Seattle.
They're all division. games. Those are tough calls.
Yeah, so those are all games where you don't expect a win, just because, you know, I've written about this on Revenge of the Birds quite a bit. The best conference in the NFL is the NFC West. And so when you're talking about, you know, 3 of the top 10 teams or 12 teams residing in the NFC West, that's going to make a team that's trying to find their footing and make their own mark, it's going to make it difficult for them to win those games. So I would say their winnable games are, you know, this week in Tampa, and then their final 3 home games. And then if they were to sneak one out, it would be somewhere on the road in the division. I don't expect it to happen, but I wouldn't be completely flabbergasted to see them win any of those 3 road games, especially late against Seattle, where Seattle may not have much to play for if San Francisco stays as hot as they are, and Seattle's already wrapped up, you know, the wild card position, and they can't get any higher than the 5 or 6 seed possibly.
For me, looking forward, kind of the games that are left, I think I'm going to be a little bit disappointed if they don't get to 6 wins. And I can viably see that happening. A 6-9-1 team that goes winless in the division, thinking that they're going to beat one of these NFC West teams on the road is a really, really tough thing to call. You really can't predict that with any sort of surety. And even the Rams at home, I still think the Rams are significantly better than the Cardinals overall. Unless the Cardinals can fix some things defensively, I think they could easily get beat. Now, they've got 3 games that I believe that they should win. And that doesn't mean they will win, but they should win. So if we're looking at it this way, three games I believe they should win. They should win in Tampa, they should beat Pittsburgh, and they should beat Cleveland, especially they're both those teams playing at home. Now, if they win two out of those three games, it's not the end of the world, and it would be ideal if they could sneak a win, one out of three wins the rest of the way. I think there is upset potential in San Francisco, simply because a team like the 49ers isn't going to run the table, so they will have a stinker. And that, you know, the Cardinals matched up pretty well with them at home. They could sneak one. I'm not going to predict it, but that's a potential win there. And I think at the end of this season, I think that's just too hard a thing to call to win in LA, unless the Rams season kind of went sideways the rest of the way, and they need to reset. I don't think they're going to win in Seattle, but I think three wins is kind of the baseline the rest of the way. They won three of their first eight games. I kind of expect them now to win three of their last seven games. And which, well, let's be honest, 6-9-1, looking competitive, that is so much better. And I think everyone, every Cardinals fan, after what happened last season, if they could have said, give me a 6-6 win team in Kingsbury's first year with Kyler Murray, I think everyone would have signed up for that. I'm okay with that. I like it. But I will say, if they only win five games, I will be a little bit disappointed. A little bit. I think six wins becomes kind of my baseline of what I believe they should do.
Yeah, and I think that's fair, and that would be a massive improvement on last season. They would double their win total. They would only lose nine games, which is what I had them at this year. And it would, and again, and maybe the defense picks it up. Maybe they find their way a little bit and they get a little bit better. But if you're doing that with this poor of a defensive effort, I don't really think that there's anything to be disappointed about. What that does is that really, really shows you where the glaring needs and focus needs to be this offseason. I wrote a piece about the offensive line and how they've played, you know, not horrible, and that, you know, you open the show with it. This five, if it stays this way, this might be their best five, and that would just leave DJ Humphreys and AQ Shipley as guys that need to be retained to keep that offensive line intact for 2020. Now, people might say, oh, but you can upgrade those positions. Yeah, can you? I mean, really, can you? We've watched this offensive line for seven seasons under Bruce Arians, or sorry, Steve Keim. Can we really expect just to go out and upgrade that offensive line? So, I mean, if they stay healthy and they continue to grow and get better every week like they have, I would think it would be responsible to at least try and keep the offensive line together for one more year for the cohesiveness of the group, which means then your free agency offseason is really then focused on what the weak spots of your team are, and that's clearly on the defensive side of the ball and clearly, you know, on the wide receiver position. And that makes kind of going into things a lot easier. If you're saying, hey, let's turn over two-fifths of our offensive line, we need to fix the defense, hey, we need wide receivers as well, I mean, you don't have enough money, draft picks, or time to get that done in one offseason. So if you're saying, hey, our offense has grown this much already, look, we won six games, and our defense was bad to maybe horrid, then it just becomes this obvious thing of, hey, we fix this, and all of a sudden we are, maybe you're not a contender, and I think that would be foolish to expect that with a second year coach and quarterback, but all of a sudden, hey, now all of a sudden we're looking at this 8-10 win season, and then in year three we're looking at, because now we've been able to really focus and get everything dialed in, and now we're ready to look at this as a team that is ready to compete in year the Murray kind of rookie contract and has 2 years left of that, you know, pseudo able to play it out type thing and really go all in.
Coming up next on the Rise Up C-Red podcast, we're going to wrap the show looking ahead at the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, whom they play this weekend. A team that can put up a lot of points and gives up a ton of points. What can we look forward to in this matchup and the reunion with Bruce Arians and a whole bunch of coaches and a whole bunch of players? That's coming up next on Rise Up C-Red. We're back on the Rise Up C-Red podcast, the best of Cardinals talk on the web. Cardinals head to Tampa, Florida this weekend. They will face a team that has a lot of familiar faces, but not necessarily to this iteration of the team. But for Cardinals fans, they have a whole slew of coaches that are former Cardinals coaches. Bruce Arians, number one. Todd Bowles, Byron Leftwich, Amos Jones. There's a whole bunch. In addition to a number of players who were former Cardinals. They just added Sam Acho, for crying out loud, who was a draft pick of them over 10 years ago. You've got a bunch of guys on that roster that are familiar. Tampa is an interesting case because they have one of the most prolific offenses in terms of points, but they turn the ball over like mad, and they cannot stop a soul. This game could be and should be kind of like those games that the Cardinals had against their three-game winning streak. Tampa's not a good team, but they're dangerous. Where are the matchups that obviously the Tampa has the advantage?
Offensively. I mean, they are going to throw the ball all around the yard, and we have seen unequivocally the Arizona Cardinals are not going to put up much, if any, resistance. The Cardinals' passing defense is one of the worst I've ever seen. They're third to last in yards, or they've given up the third most yards on the season. They've given up the second most touchdowns. They have the least amount of takeaways. It is a all around pathetic effort outside of Chandler Jones' respectable sack numbers. That is going to be a problem when you look at what Jameis Winston has done. I talked about it the other day on the site. You know, Winston, through his first eight games under Bruce Arians, is putting up better numbers than what Carson Palmer did outside of completion percentage under Arians. I mean, he's thrown 16 touchdowns this season. He's on pace to throw 32 touchdowns. Now, he is on pace to throw 24 interceptions, but we all know that comes with the territory of the Bruce Arians offense. Now, he's being sacked more than he ever has in his career. He's actually only five away from tying his career high in sacks taken, which is, you know, absurd to think about that. But again, Bruce Arians offense, and he fumbles the ball a lot. I mean, a lot. And so when you look at it, you have an offense in Tampa Bay that is just going to be able to throw the ball around. They have a fantastic duo of wide receivers in both Mike Evans and Chris Godwin. So, I mean, Evans is on pace for 1,700 yards, 100 catches, 1,700 yards, and 14 touchdowns. I mean, his yardage production is basically double the top Cardinals receiver in Larry Fitzgerald. Running the ball, they're fine. I mean, they're not bad, but they are a team that's going to throw the ball all over the field, and I would wager they're going to do it successfully because that's who Bruce Arians is as a play caller. You know, they're sixth in pass attempts and seventh in yards, which means they're very I wouldn't say efficient, but they're very good at throwing the football, and they do it effectively. And then they're not terrible running the ball, and they do, you know, and then when you talk about the other side of it, they are great against the run. I mean, they're still the number one ranked team in terms of yards given up on the ground in rushing. the Cardinals and specifically Kyler Murray have to come out and throw the ball well in this game, because if there's one team that is as bad against the pass as the Arizona Cardinals, it is the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. They've allowed the second most yards in the NFL. They've allowed the fifth most touchdowns in the NFL. They have only intercepted the ball five times. So they don't force turnovers. They don't defend the pass well. It is a game where we may see two quarterbacks throw for over 400 yards and four plus touchdowns in a game, because that's just what the expectations are. Now, we talk about it, which means we'll probably see a 14-10 type slugfest. But right now, weather-wise, it's clear. There's no rain. There's no wind in Tampa, scheduled for Sunday. It's supposed to be in the 70s at kickoff. It's going to be prime passing situations, and the Cardinals have to take advantage of how bad the Bucs defense is, just as much as the Bucs are going to attack and take advantage of how bad the Cardinals defense is.
So it sounds like what it's going to come down to is potentially this: the Cardinals don't turn the ball over much. The Tampa Bay Bucs turn the ball over a lot. So it will become basically the biggest point of emphasis for the defense is to get the ball away. This is a game where Chandler Jones and Terrell, like, they need to take the ball away from Jameis Winston a couple of times at least. And that way they simply take away drives.
Right. And this game could mirror the Atlanta game quite a bit, where it may just come down to a team missing a kick, where a team is unable to block well enough for their quarterback and they give up a strip sack, or they get an extra point block or miss one. Matt Gay hasn't been great for the kicker for the Tampa Bay Bucs. So I mean, this is definitely a game where it would be more about what team messes it up more than what team stops the other one. Because I truthfully don't see either team stopping the other.
And that's going to be fun to see. I do hope to see the Cardinals manage to do some damage on the ground. And if they don't do it on the ground, I think they'll be prepared for the running game with the running backs. I want to see Kyler Murray cut it loose. That's the one thing we haven't seen much, except against Cincinnati. He hasn't cut it loose much. I want to see it. I want to see that more. I think I want that part of the offense to open up. And yes, of course, I want him to be careful, but I want that option used more than it has been this year, because I think it will unlock a little bit more of that offense. That said, if I have to pick how this game is going to go, hit the over. If you're looking at the point, hit the over. There's going to be a lot of points. And let's call this what it's going to be. I think this is going to be a 34-31 Cardinals win.
Yeah, and I think the Cardinals can pull this game out. I've not been impressed with Tampa Bay from a defensive perspective, nor have I the Cardinals. So, it's not picking on Tampa in any way. And I think the Cardinals can win this game 38-35.
Awesome. So with that, let's wrap up the show. We'll be back again next week to talk about how things went. Hopefully the Cardinals have won their fourth game of the season. This is episode 246 of the Rise Up Seabird podcast. That's Seth Cox. I'm Jess Root. Thanks for listening. We'll be back again next week. Thanks for listening. Thanks for listening to the latest edition of the Rise Up Seabird podcast. Listen to previous episodes and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher Radio, Audioboom, or many other podcast platforms, so shows are delivered directly to your mobile device. Please give the show a 5-star rating and always support the sponsors who support the show. We'll be back soon for the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Rise up, Red Sea, be Red Sea Red, and of course, Rise Up, Sea Red.